All right, we're here back at the Real Estate Roundtable with IPRG. I'm joined today with Lux Proviero, and we have a guest, Russ Walkler from NNN Pro Group. Russ is a senior managing director over at NNN Pro. So welcome, Russ.
Thanks for having me, guys. Excited to be here. Love the office, too. Just walking around there. Your views are definitely a lot prettier than ours in the Midtown. Loving it.
Yeah,
appreciate that. We're happy with it. The downtown views are good. The buildings are not. It's not so condensed. You see the river. You can see some stuff.
Yeah.
The Midtown's great.
Definitely a perk. But
yeah.
Cool. No, thanks for having me.
Yeah, 100%. Right. We've known you for a long time. Done a lot of business together. You've been in the net lease space for, I think, almost 20 years.
Coming up on it, yeah.
Wow.
Let's catch up a little bit. But just before we start, I just want to run through like the docket of what we're planning to talk about today. So the listeners can kind of jump around if they so choose. And we'll see where this whole conversation goes. But we're going to start off talking about the net lease asset class as a whole. And we'll talk about like underwriting and just the different angles and aspects to the net lease marketplace, I guess, which is around the country.
Yep.
We'll talk about 1031 exchange buyers and how that makes up a portion of the net lease space. We'll talk about sale leasebacks.
Yes.
We'll talk about bonus depreciation. And then towards the end, we'll talk about, I guess you could say net lease development or repositioning net lease properties and some creative deals and deal structures that you've worked on.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you want to start at the top?
Let's catch up for a minute. How's everything going? I mean, the market has changed a lot in a lot of ways for us. I mean, the interest rates, we're talking in November of 2023, and interest rates has really been like at the top of everyone's mind. So just like broadly speaking, how are things going and how's that impacting you guys?
Oh, yeah. So just like you guys, it obviously has an impact on our business. It has an impact on real estate across the board. When you're looking to finance a transaction, interest rates are higher today. So your cost of capital is higher, so you can't afford to pay the same that maybe you were previously able to pay and accept the same returns. So there is an impact. Cap rates are trending higher today. It's kind of cyclical like your business, and we're seeing similar trends, maybe not the same extent of the swings. We're seeing it more on the institutional side. Just their dividends are higher, their cost of capital is higher, so the publicly traded REITs and the people in that bucket are obviously chasing higher yield today. And then the private market, I think it depends on the price point. Where we're talking about, call it below $3 million, there's still a huge private market, and those people, it's just a larger buyer pool. They're willing to pay a little bit more than mostly all cash transactions, even though there are financing options out there. And there's everything in between, but cap rates are definitely higher today than they were a year ago, and we'll see what the future holds here, but I do think once the financing market starts to stabilize a little bit, it'll free up more liquidity, and I do expect to see more transactions for you guys and for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like from our side of the table, right, like when we do deals together, like our colleagues who deals with your group, mm-hmm. We really pass it off to you. You guys do the deals, and I don't know how the financing works, but I guess you put the clients in touch with the right banks. Is it the same type of banks that we're dealing with that you guys deal with, or is it banks that are set up to do like triple net deals?
So it's both and everything in between.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of success finding local credit unions in certain markets and partnering with mortgage brokers that do specialize in net lease. It's been kind of hit or miss. There are some national and regional banks that are still active in the net lease space. I think more banks are still getting educated on net lease and growing in the sector, but are going to allocate more money to it on the go forward. But every now and then you find your local credit union that's a diamond in the rough that's offering 50, 100 basis points or just better terms, better AM, whatever the case might be in certain markets versus others.
All right.
You got to treat each deal or each property an opportunity like its own.
And everything's different, right? It's like us with like location, different tenants command a more compressed cap rate than others, obviously. There's still tenants that are still around the same yield, even though the interest rates are much higher.
Yeah, there's some, call it best in class.
Yeah. Like
the Chick-fil-A's, the McDonald's, people just, there's pride of ownership there. People get excited by those concepts. They want to own them. And those cap rates have trickled up a little bit, but not as much as you would think. There's definitely people chasing best in class. And you could sleep at night knowing you have Chick-fil-A. I mean, their average sales are over $8 million a store now. It's kind of astronomical numbers. And there's some people that are just chasing ultimate safety and return secondary, just making sure the money's there every month is most important.
All right.
All right, so let's take it back a step here. Let's set the table properly. So a net lease property, mm-hmm. like this is what you sell the stuff across the country.
Yep.
What are the net lease properties? Like, just help me understand this. Say that I've never heard about the asset class.
Sure, yeah. And, let's break
you know,
it down.
Some broker, say I'm an owner, and some broker approaches me and says, hey, man, sell your apartment building. Don't deal with the tenants. 1031 exchange, buy a net lease. Mm-hmm. So, like, what is this whole thing about?
So, as you guys are familiar, in your world, you're dealing with very management-intensive properties.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm sure
this is true.
That a lot of your landlords are just those midnight phone calls where your roof's leaking, the toilet's clogged, whatever the case might be. There's a lot of responsibility that comes with owning a multifamily building, especially New York's not making it any easier. I hear everybody complaining. So
it's also true.
But a net lease property essentially holds the tenant responsible for everything at the property, from taxes, insurance, maintenance, the works. So a true triple net asset is almost more of a bond-like return. There are some minimal responsibilities, we'll say. I don't want to say it's totally 100% hands-off. You might have some minimal responsibility on an annual basis. But in the grand scheme of things, it's way more passive. It's not very time-consuming. The money comes in. A lot of these are big corporations. They'll wire you the money on the first of every month. And you're just taking out some of the guessing games with whatever your capital expenses might be, because the tenant's responsible for everything in a true net lease.
Got it. So you're the landlord, you buy the real estate, you own the land and the building, and then you have a lease with some company, some corporation.
Yep.
And they, in the lease, they pay the real estate taxes, they pay the insurance, they pay the repairs, and they pay rent.
Correct. So the lease really dictates it, but then the better structured leases, it really is a passive form of ownership.
So like the toilet overflows at Chipotle, like that's on Chipotle. Like you're not going to get a call about that.
You don't even get a phone call. Nope.
Yeah.
That's on the tenant to deal with.
Sweet.
You're not getting phone calls. So it's different, right? I mean, the people coming from your world, I've had so many cases where, oh, New York's real estate is what we know and what we own. Our family's had it for generations. And we've had people maybe dip their toe in, like, all right, I'll test out net lease. Let me try it on one property. Just this thing, this building's a nightmare. Let me go buy something passive. And those are the people that 5, 6, 10 transactions later, they're changing the whole structure of their portfolio. They're seeing the beauty of how it works. And it's just more consistent income with less headaches. That's the goal.
So the main metric you look at in the sale of these is you're looking at the cap rate, you're looking at the yield that the property generates relative to the price?
That's a piece of the puzzle. A lot of times the cap rate's indicative of the credit. Like just like every other investment in the world, there are risks even in net lease. And if you're buying the best credit with the longest term leases in the best locations, they're going to have the lowest cap rate, which because they're taking on the least amount of risk.
What's the lowest cap rate property you've ever seen sell?
There's been unique situations, but let's just call it more of a down the middle type transaction.
Yeah.
You saw Chick-fil-A's and McDonald's trading in the threes.
In the three caps.
Yeah.
And how about now? Where's the market at today?
There's still some McDonald's and Chick-fil-A's trading close to four. Like maybe you could still dip your toe in the three cap range, which doesn't make a lot of sense from a financing standpoint, but there are people that just want ultimate safety or love the real estate or love the concept for one reason or another. That's more the exception, not the norm today, but it does still exist.
And how about on the high end, like not the unique situations, but like the down the middle type of properties, what's like a high
down the middle,
yield?
I'd say,
and what
is
more, that look like?
You could get a nice blend of credit and real estate somewhere between the 6 and 7% return today. Like the numbers are definitely higher. And every person's different.
Explain what you mean by credit and real estate.
Sure. So just who's signing your lease? So what tenant is actually guaranteeing that rent? Is it a small franchisee or is it Chase Bank? Is it a big publicly traded corporation? And just understanding who's actually making sure that rent payment comes every month and managing and maintaining the property. And there's everything in between. And we've kind of, and part of the process is getting to know each client and understanding their risk tolerance and what's going to be attractive to them. And we'll talk more about it later about bonus depreciation and other tax strategies in the net lease world. But we I often joke and I say Florida is the sixth borough of New York because so many people here have a primary residence in Florida that they're in for at least 6 months and one day a year. So they don't pay state income tax. Mm-hmm. And they'll only buy properties in income tax-free states so they could take advantage of that. So they're and they could also write off trips to Florida. There's other benefits and perks to doing so, but it really is catered to each individual client. We want to get to know them. We want to understand their likes, dislikes, beliefs, and the beauty is New York's kind of a defined space, and I know most of your investors will be like, hey, I only invest in Williamsburg. I only invest in a certain market. Net lease, I have owners here in New York that own in probably in all 50 states at this point.
Really?
So they're,
that's cool.
There's just certain draws, and that's a way to diversify your portfolio through location, credits, tenants. There's a lot of ways to kind of hedge your bets.
So I have a quick question. So obviously things change as Amazon and all this stuff, like mm-hmm. different businesses are hot at different times. But you brought up, you said like the golden child. You said two places, obviously McDonald's and Chick-fil-A, both are food places. Yeah. Is fast food, that type of thing, the Chipotle's, the McDonald's, all that, is that the hottest thing right now?
I personally have always liked fast food.
Yeah.
I've found that like the McDonald's locations that I grew up near are still McDonald's. And
correct.
Yeah.
In good economies and bad economies, they do well. So I like that they're smaller, more, I don't want to call them bite size. Everything's millions of dollars here. But
How much are they?
Anywhere from 1 to 2 million to
for
seven or for to 4 and 5, 6, 7 million. It just depends where and what rent they could afford to pay and what deal was struck with the developer or the tenant. We'll get into it later,
but or 30 million or 40 million.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's much larger.
And
scale,
I'd love to actually click into how much rent they can pay. Like how do these companies determine like what the rent is that they can pay in these locations? It's all based on
so
store sales and.
Correct. Like they have their internal metrics. And we could, might be a good segue to talk about sale leasebacks, which is a big part of our business.
Sure.
And I'll tie it into the restaurant world too, even though this goes way beyond that to other types of uses and tenants. But specifically on the restaurant space, we meet with operators, a lot of times franchisees or corporations, and we help them come up with a strategy of how much rent they could comfortably afford to pay. And whether it's a percent of sales or certain EBITDA coverages, part of the goal is to make sure they're successful and paying a rent that they could support long term and helping them figure out what that metric is where they could rent that they could support versus maximizing value on the sale leaseback.
So, okay, can you just, I'm not sure if everyone listening understands, but what is a sale leaseback?
Sure. So a sale leaseback is a relationship where a tenant may own the business and the real estate at a location. And we work with these tenants to come up with a strategy where they basically bifurcate the business and the real estate. They would then sell the real estate to an individual or a REIT, a high net worth individual, somebody that wants to own this real estate and have a long-term commitment from the tenant. So a lot of tenants are in the flipping burger game. They're not in the real estate game.
That's like McDonald's whole thing.
They're a little unique right? example because yeah. they have some ties to real estate. But yeah. let's just say the Burger King franchisee basically doesn't need to have all of his capital tied up in his real estate. So we could structure a sale leaseback where he could sell you guys his location, commit to a 20-year lease term with options. So he's controlling that real estate for a very long period of time. And the money he's able to pull out from there can be used to grow his business, to pay off debt, to be used to renovate, whatever his capital mm-hmm. needs are. But they have a ton of like equity and liquidity tied up in their real estate that they might not need it there.
And so you guys meet with these business owners. You go through the numbers in terms of what they're bringing in, what their
Correct.
Costs are, and you basically determine what the lease structure and the rent structure should look like.
Exactly.
And how much money they'll get in a sale.
Yeah, we'll walk through different scenarios with them and kind of give them the whole menu of, hey, if we run it this way, here's how the numbers look, and we could tweak it and do things slightly different, and it would look like this. But
just to back it up a little farther, because I understand. So like a sure. Burger King, right? So people actually still own, like they have the lease and the building?
So there's a lot of...
Is that common? Because isn't it?
It is. There's a lot of tenants that own their real estate, and... They didn't buy it as necessarily an investment. They bought it to build a business there. They didn't buy it as a real estate investment.
But that business is a corporate guaranteed business, right? So are they like building a building? And
we've done them for corporations. Like, yeah. You know, Panera Bread is one of our team's big clients.
Yeah.
And them specifically, they go and build stores.
Okay.
And once it's built,
real estate?
They'll buy it, they'll build it. And then once it's built, they'll go and sell it just to recoup the cost because they don't want so much capital tied up in real estate. They want to take the proceeds to go open another location. And that's where they're really making their 15, 20% a year on making sandwiches and selling salads.
Interesting.
So it's just, it's untapped.
The whole real estate division where they're buying, putting themselves in, signing a lease, and then liquidating.
It frees up the capital so they could go replicate. No, they're, them specifically, they're not even really taking profits. I mean, from their situation, they just want to take the money and roll it into another store.
Why are they buying this space in the first place? Why not just lease it?
They have their own real estate team, their own construction crews. They could do things the way they want to and set the rent that levels they're comfortable.
I kind of get that. Yeah. Like you have to have it, everything look the same, same materials, same style, same everything. And you probably have one builder or not one builder, but like one team.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense.
Now they have a model that works and a lot of these corporations just, you have better uses for the capital instead of owning real estate.
I agree with that.
They can make more yield elsewhere.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. So we spoke, I feel like, about the food piece of the net lease market a little bit, but like what other asset classes are there and what are the trends in that space and how are those different types of asset classes performing?
So everybody hears net lease that's in the industry and it's always like, oh, Walgreens, CVS, some Chase Bank, some of the standard like thoughts that come to mind, but we've tried to be creative. I mean, we created the market for car washes and we did about $1.5 billion plus in sales last year. And again, that's bonus depreciation related. We'll touch on that later, but we've done funeral homes. We've done amusement parks. We were talking about a nightclub we did in Brooklyn a few years ago. Any freestanding building or property anywhere in the country, we could essentially put a net lease on.
I think we've done done gas stations together.
Yeah.
Funeral homes are pretty good. And that makes sense to me.
Yeah,
because I mean, it can't be replaced. It's, people are dying.
It's a pretty recession-proof business.
Everyone dies, so it's like that's pretty good.
That and food.
Food.
Yeah.
Banks scare me, and this is just things that are replaced. Right, obviously, like everyone can bank on their cell phone, right? Like, do you really like? I still like. I'm somewhat old school. Like, I like going to an ATM, putting my check in instead of like scanning it on my phone. People do that. Obviously, most people do it. I don't. But do you really have to go to these bank branches?
So. Banks have realized this too, right?
Yeah.
Like they're not building the grandioso banks they used to build. They're now building smaller footprints, less tellers, more ATMs. They're like catering to their customers' needs. But I will say, I'll bet on Chase's credit. I wouldn't mind owning the Chase Bank. If Chase goes out as a business, we have a lot bigger issues in this country.
Plus, it makes sense now that I'm thinking about this. Like Soho, right? Like none of the businesses in Soho make money, but they need to have be recognized by the people walking around. So people have to see their
Some of it's a marketing expense.
I mean, maybe Bank of America is always on my mind because I'm walking around the scene. I see Bank of America, Bank of America. Like, if you're not seeing it, it's almost not really in your life, right? It makes sense.
Doesn't make sense.
You're not there every day, but it's part of their marketing, part of their advertising, and they're going to keep morphing and catering and customizing to clients' needs.
Do you feel like bank is still a safe bet?
I think bank credit's still very safe. I think some of the older, huge bank branches – it's great real estate and you're going to have alternative uses over time, but the banks don't need the same footprint they used to.
Makes sense. And then what are your thoughts on like what Derek touched on, like the CVS's, the Walgreens, cause that's also like an Amazon / delivery issue, right?
Yeah. I mean, I can make arguments on both sides of the fence. We've kind of heard it all from clients just through discussions and good real estate and good markets always has value. So,
okay.
I know specifically the drugstores, Rite Aid has its troubles now, and they're out there trying to get some reductions from landlords and trying to just figure out the next phase of their business. But people who bought good real estate and good markets are going to be fine. And that's part of our process is kind of pointing out the good, the bad, and the ugly on every investment and making sure the client understands, hey, here's what can happen, here's what may happen, and some of them will be a win. Maybe it's a Rite Aid that's been there for 30 years on the cheap rent and you're excited to get rid of them and you could get much better rent and higher rent and from a better use.
Yeah, for sure. If the location warrants, I mean, there's like the Walgreens in Park Slope, I'm sure, on Fifth Avenue. or Dwayne Reed, whatever it is. I'm sure they would love to have them go out. They can get way more. Oh, yeah. It's like
they're encumbering all the value. Yeah. I think it's a development site. There's a bunch of air rights.
Development sites.
There's the lease in place and to below market, significantly below market.
You go to these places too.
Relative to the vacant value.
Yeah, you go to these Dwayne Reeds, like the one by our office.
Mm-hmm.
The one by our office down here on Broadway, I think one in three people is just stealing from them.
It's not one in three.
Or it's a one in five. It's insane. You see, every time I'm in there, there's someone running out with stuff, right? And it's like you feel like a kind of like a schmuck in line, like I'm paying for this. It's like everyone's just robbing them.
It's a real problem, and they are closing stores in certain markets because
they are, yeah. I mean,
everyone's a slap on the wrist if you get caught stealing.
In San Francisco, all these tenants closed everything.
You can't. Yeah. Like, I watched a guy like 2 days ago, I think it was Monday, he walked out with a full meal. Comes in, he's like, I missed a sandwich today, some cheese, a drink, and just walks out. It's just like, it's whatever.
It's a problem. And certain areas like San Francisco and certain markets, it's a real issue. And some of the stores are no longer profitable because they're being robbed blind, literally. And there's nothing that you could do with the local laws, and it's caused issues.
All right. So just a segue.
So at NNN Pro, you guys have people calling the market trying to find owners of net lease properties that will list and sell their properties with you.
Correct.
So like one of the associates comes running up to you and they just call the guy and the person wants to sell their net lease property. Could be anything.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about valuing the property? Do you just slap a cap rate on it, or are you looking into like the rent per foot and the demographics of the market?
The traffic.
Yeah, the traffic.
So we look into
how do you value one of these deals?
Sure. We look into everything. We have a pretty thorough approach of how we look at these assets. One, we take pride. Our team goes and visits every asset we list. So I will know a lot of our competitors don't necessarily do that. And we have so much technology at our fingertips today where it's less necessary, but there still is value. You still want to know what's going on with the neighbors. How's the property look? More than just a couple pictures. Maybe Amazon's opening or closing a facility up the road. You won't know that until you actually go down there and look around. And you also just get a little bit of a gut check. There's no like perfect science on what we do. We it's kind of a blend of checking a lot of boxes and doing whatever homework we can. But we will look at all the comps. We'll look at the credit of the tenant. We'll look at the blend of the lease term and the rental increases. We'll review the lease. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it.
Got it.
And each one's different. Like as much as it might be two Walgreens with 15 years on the lease in different markets, we might value them differently. Even though it's the same credit.
Okay, so you look at you say that you do a gut check.
Yeah.
Like what is the gut check? Is it to like is there like a risk that the tenant's going to leave? Do the tenants leave? Is there risk that they're not going to pay?
Not even that the tenant's going to leave, but you'll go see the real estate and you'll get a certain feel for it. And I probably should have brought this up previously. Even with Chase Bank and Walgreens, if you're buying good credit, and then we were talking about how they're closing stores in certain markets just because they're getting robbed and there's certain reasons why it doesn't make economic sense to keep those stores open, they still owe you the rent. You're an obligation on their balance sheet. They're still paying rent on those locations. They just made the business decision to close the store, but they can't get out of the lease.
They can't get out of the lease.
No.
So this is for any company or just like for these big corporations?
I mean, it depends how the lease is written, obviously, and you want to make sure you hire an attorney. And I've read thousands of lease at this point, but I still say hire an attorney, hire an accountant, hire the professionals in each sector just to kind of check your boxes. But in a true triple net lease, the tenant's on the hook. I mean, I've seen plenty of situations where it was just a business decision to close the store, but they're still paying rent for 15 years.
What's the thought process behind that?
They just thought it would be...
Didn't Starbucks do that?
Starbucks did that on a lot of locations.
Wasn't Starbucks paying rent that was like $250 a foot when the market was like $30 a foot? Like they were paying significantly above market, like high rents. And then they just like stopped. They closed down a lot of stores.
They closed the stores, but they still had to pay those rents. They still had lease obligations.
But when the lease expires, the rent will never... I mean, that was like
it might be hard to replicate.
Okay.
But it's just Starbucks specifically. I think it was in 2009. The market obviously took a dip. Starbucks was still a very healthy company, but they were opening on every corner. There was Starbucks opening across the street from Starbucks, next to Starbucks. They were opening everywhere in the city. And eventually they realized they were cannibalizing themselves. And they're like, we can't have this many stores this close. So they were closing locations and they approached certain landlords and said, hey, Mr. and Mrs. Landlord, your location is just not profitable for certain reasons. We have 8 years left on this lease. Is it okay if we try to sublease it? Or maybe we could work out some sort of buyout where they'll pay you, hey, if we offer you 4 years rent today, will you let us off the hook? And you could say, yeah, great. Give me the 4 years rent. I'll go hire a local leasing broker and re-tenant this property and I'll be fine. Or you say, no, I don't want to deal with it. You guys try to sublease it, but keep paying my rent for the lease term. Mm-hmm. So if you're buying good credit, you are somewhat insulated there.
Got it. What about, so something that I've been seeing a lot of, at least in New York, we saw a lot of it on apartment buildings. And I was speaking with a buddy of mine who invests a lot out west, and he said he was experiencing it. But I feel like there's a lot of scenarios where the real estate taxes are shooting up on people, and it's a very difficult thing for investors to underwrite, because they just, in many cases, just don't know the calculation or how the tax is increased. And I'm just wondering, in like the net lease space, when you're the landlord and you're just getting your check in the mail every month, mm-hmm. you may not know what's going on behind the scenes, where the real estate taxes might go from like 50 grand a year to 90 grand a year. And it has a big impact. Yeah. And I was going to mention insurance as well, but you have these costs that these tenants are picking up that are significantly increasing. And how does that play into, I guess, just the overall,
lease.
Yeah. The lease and the merit of the net lease property.
It's a great point. So first off, unlike a more management intensive building where you eat all those costs, your tenant's the one eating these costs, which is kind of nice from the landlord's seat, but ultimately it impacts probably the profitability of their business to some degree. It's just more expensive to run businesses today. Just to build on that, even like cost of goods, labor, everything comes into play. There's bigger discussions we could have, but specifically real estate tax and insurance are two big ones. The tenants have rights to contest taxes, and oftentimes they will, and the landlord might have to sign a doc agreeing that they'll sign off and partner with them to help them achieve that. And then even on the insurance, I know Florida and some of these hurricane areas, those costs have tripled, quadrupled, or if you can even get insurance in certain markets, it's definitely more challenging, but it's on the tenants to figure this out, and hopefully it's a strong enough location, a strong enough credit tenant where it doesn't impact their ability to pay the rent to any degree.
Mm-hmm. Are you having such, like, the insurance is a big one, even for us now, like frame buildings, like buildings with violations, like insurance companies are like really smartening up.
And what we're seeing is nothing compared to what's going on in other markets.
For sure. But I'm just making a point that even in New York, we're seeing it. So like, I can only imagine, let's take, you mentioned Florida. Florida is an obvious one for storms and hurricanes and whatnot. Would a tenant, are you seeing situations where tenants are going back to the landlords and like, hey, my taxes were eight and now they're 24? Thousand a year, like that changes things, right?
It depends. I mean, if it's a smaller tenant, you probably took some more risks buying a smaller tenant, meaning you got a higher return going in day one, but the tenant may say, hey, look, here's the economics, this X, Y, and Z change. Would you be willing to help? It's not an everyday thing that happens in that manner, but it can. But it's rare you're going to get a call from Chase Bank or Home Depot saying our taxes went up. They're just going to eat it. They're obligated to the lease. They're paying it.
This is very good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think for us, we kind of are drawn to like, well, what's the risk? What's the exposure? Yeah. What could potentially happen? But I think if you take a step back and you're like the landlord, and I mean, you're just getting some really nice, easy, consistent cash flow coming in off these things.
Yeah, especially if you're like somewhat smart about it, good location, good credit.
Yeah, and people like, can take risks. Sure, I could sell you a 10 cap, and there's going to be obvious risk that's come with it. And if it works out, great. You're making 10% return on your money, but you're definitely taking risk to achieve that type of return. And again, just part of us being experts in the space is educating the clients and kind of pointing out everything and saying, hey, look, I'll show you this return, but here's what comes with it. Or you get a much lower return, but you could sleep at night. And everybody has different buckets they're trying to fill and different views on the world. And it's just really trying to cater to everybody.
So I think it's a good point to transition into the whole 1031 aspect of the net lease market. So like, how much of the market is made up of 1031 buyers.
It's a significant percentage. Mm-hmm. And as New York velocity's down and velocity around the country's down, there's less buyers out there. There's still some residual ones from transactions that closed 6 months ago and some transactions getting done. There's definitely less today. But we found there are plenty of high net worth and family offices who invest in net lease now. I think the whole segment is still growing and people are, as much as you've heard of it, there's still people that haven't and are still getting educated. There's mm-hmm. both public and privately traded REITs.
Yeah.
There's different funds trying to accomplish and hit different, fill different buckets. So there's more than just exchange buyers in the marketplace. There's a lot of people that just like this asset class, and I think we'll continue to see it grow.
And they like the asset class for the ease of management and the cash flow and the long-term credit worthiness of the tenants. That's basically what the appeal is, right?
It's definitely part of it. And as we talked, we're talking about a little earlier, we're even seeing some foreign capital come in where they want to get money into the States and invest in the U.S., but taking on management intensive buildings, it's hard, right? Mm-hmm. It requires a lot of work and just paying attention to it it requires a lot of paying attention to a lot of detail. And net lease is just a much easier form of real estate ownership.
And that fund we were with 2 days ago, they brought it up.
And you saw like in Williamsburg, I think there's an institutional investor that just purchased recently purchased a large property there. I mean, you're seeing it even in New York City, institutional investors. I think, there's been a bunch.
Makes sense.
No, and it's all around the country. I mean, I know we're in this New York bubble here, but there's great markets all around the U.S. and it doesn't need to be one of the big major metro cities. There's plenty of middle tier markets, but as long as there's good economic drivers, there's good validity to the real estate. Economic drivers being if the property is next to an airport, a hospital, a stadium, just something that's going to draw people to that local market, create jobs locally, and kind of just validate the real estate.
Yeah. I think it's much more like location, location, location.
Oh, yeah.
Once you leave New York City, I think New York City, most locations kind of just get away with being here in New York. So it's not, I mean, less so on the retail side. Retail is still sensitive, but
there's some of that. But it's still a blend of everything.
Yeah.
And just understanding what you're up against. And I know we're talking a lot about retail, but we're selling medical, industrial, like I said, amusement parks. Like we're really touching all different types of
uses. You guys sold an amusement park?
We did.
What's that deal about?
it was with the private equity sponsor who was in kind of growing and buying some different amusement parks during the pandemic. And we helped them structure sell leasebacks on the real estate to help finance some of the acquisition costs.
How much did those sell for?
Various price points. Some of them were sold as portfolios and just kind of different buckets. I mean, we're trying to put the net lease on everything we can. So,
I love that. So let's talk about, we talked about 1031s, which is a huge part of the market, but, there's other, like, so people obviously want to save their,
but just to further build on 1031 exchanges. So I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with 1031 exchanges, but that really what that is, it's through the tax code. It allows you to exchange from an investment property to another investment property and defer the capital gains. So we've had all kinds of people getting out of more management intensive properties, do 1031 exchanges, buy net lease, and it's been for different reasons. Some of it's people who might be in different like points in the life cycle and want something more passive. Some of it's even, I've dealt with some big owners in New York that don't feel great about the local market for one reason or another and are looking to exit and use net lease as a placeholder. I've had some guys say, hey, I'll go buy a couple good credit tenants. I'll park my money here for a few years. And when I think the time's right to enter back in New York, we'll sell these and I'll jump right back in. About preserving capital, deferring taxes.
Maybe playing the stepped up basis game.
That too. For estate planning's huge.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of people buy these and hold them and kind of keep exchanging and whatnot. And then at some point in time, when their heirs will get a stepped up basis. Mm-hmm. And we've also had too, just you've seen the generational families that the kids may not want to be managing New York multifamily.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's got to be big.
It is a big piece. Like the kids might want to be doctors or lawyers or just do something that's not managing real estate. And if you're able to exchange and not pay the capital gains and to defer the money and buy a net lease property that's way less management intensive, it's been a great use. And the tax savings we provide the clients over the years is tremendous.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, 1031 is so good. You get more, you know, you have all that extra money that you can use for cash flow.
Yeah. I mean, it's deferring huge tax gains, and it's keeping money and reinvesting into the real estate world. But it's a piece of your business too, right? Think about all the exchange buyers that are still exchanging back into multifamily or
100%. Or going up or down. It's been amazing.
Yep.
A lot of the buyers we're dealing with right now are 1031 buyers. So,
ton.
You know, it always cycles through.
And for sure.
Keeps the market moving.
Yeah, no, it's good for all.
For sure. Very good for everyone.
Yep.
So 1031 exchange, you could say, is a tax strategy, right?
It is. Definitely.
It's a tax strategy. We know people that have done it. We've done it.
Yep.
In some situations, helped a number of clients manage it.
We've done some together.
And we have.
Those clients are all happy. I still talk to them. They call, we check in once a year. And
nice.
It was a game changer for some of them.
Yeah. The 1031 can get kind of pretty complicated too, with the tax code and just the tax strategies and the basis and all sorts of things. Not getting too deep in the weeds there, but that could be a good thing to go over at some point in a future episode. But let's talk about other tax strategies. So we touched on this bonus depreciation.
Sure.
So what do we got there?
So through the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, they added a caveat that any asset that previously qualified for accelerated depreciation would now qualify for bonus depreciation. So a lot of that car washes were specifically mentioned, but also auto service, gas stations. So of those types of uses, you were able to take 100% depreciation year one, which is a tremendous savings to offset other gains you may have in your portfolio. They've now since started phasing it out. It's 80% this year. It's going down to 60% next year. But we've helped kind of through these tax codes and tax savings get more ingrained with some tenants such as car wash operators. I know private equity's gotten very involved on that side. They've helped with these car wash operators who is historically a very fragmented business where they own 2-3 locations. They figured out if we could congregate and get this up to 50 locations, just the economies of scales and the gym membership model, there's certain strategies they took on the business side. But there was also a huge captive audience looking for these tax savings and all this depreciation to offset other gains in their portfolio.
Can we give an example of how this works? So, you know, say someone comes along, they want to get some bonus depreciation, they want to show some losses against their long-term or short-term gains.
Yeah.
So say there's like a car wash for like $1 million mm-hmm. in New Jersey.
Sure.
Like, so how does it work?
Sure. So take that $1 million example. You have to deduct a portion for land, let's just say 20%. So there's $800,000 there left for the improvements. You'd be able to take an $800,000 write-off day one.
Because you bought it for 800 grand.
You bought it for $1 million, but million. You deduct a little bit for land. But that $800,000 savings is tremendous to use that to offset other income.
It becomes an $800,000 loss.
But what about the debt? The debt is...
Well, that's it too. It's almost more powerful if you put some financing on the property.
So let's say they financed
$400,000
down. And you still can take the eight.
Correct.
So let's say they put 700 grand of debt on it. They put 300 down. Someone comes to the table with 300 grand and all of a sudden they're wiping off 800,000 on their active income.
You might need a hair higher down, but yes.
Yeah.
So,
but now they have an issue. Right? Is there not an issue? Because all of a sudden their basis is zero.
So your basis is zero.
The debt is 700 grand.
Well, taking the debt aside for a second, yes, that you have the debt and you'll have to repay the debt. And that's like any other type of real estate ownership. But the savings today has tremendous value just from net present value standpoint. Think about all the savings today that you might be saving over the next 15 years. You get the benefit of all that today.
Got it.
And then... When you do sell, you now have no basis anymore, but you sell and do a 1031 exchange. I like car washes as an investment. These places are cash cows in a lot of cases. They make a ton of money and there's some good credit tenant operators in the space now. and maybe you like that investment for the long term, or maybe you don't and you sell it and do a 1031 exchange into something else at some point in time. Yeah.
Car wash to me is great because I actually just do like the business. Like you said,
I do too. They're very expensive to build, but once they're open, it's a high margin business.
Yeah. And people wash their cars. I mean, there's no really replacing that.
Yeah. Even if cars, if you believe electric cars are taking over the world, you still have to clean them.
So, okay. So the play is then you did the bonus depreciation and then you just either sit on the property of no basis. There's no more depreciation and you cash flow it and pay your mortgage. Yep. Or you 1031 exchange and buy something else, but your basis still carries through to that. So essentially that 300 grand that you just put into the property, mm-hmm. you're not seeing that 300 grand back. Basically you put the 300 in to like get the $800,000 loss, but then you're leaving the 300 in the investment for
forever. You're probably rolling that on the go forward, but I have to assume most clients in the commercial real estate sector that are spending $1 million of properties are going to be in the high tax bucket. And it's a tremendous savings. You're saving more than the $300,000 you used as the down payment there.
Yeah, you're saving at least 300.
Yeah, it's going to be more. Yeah. So it's a very powerful vehicle. There's been all kinds of people creating funds around this and just high net worth individuals, different corporations, and a lot of people are in the sector. And you get the same benefits for gas stations if more than 50% of the sales come from fuel sales. So there's... it's been a nice little boost in certain
In this scenario, if you were to sell it, now you still have to pay the 700 grand back to the bank. Say you sell it for like $1 million or 1.1 even, mm-hmm. 1.2, maybe it goes up in value.
Okay.
But you have to pay back the 700 grand to the bank. And then if you're not doing a 1031 and you...
Then you'll have some depreciation recapture to deal
depreciation
with.
Depreciation
and
recapture.
So there will be amount. Some...
So you basically have to put all the money back into the taxes.
You get the benefits today.
What's that?
You got to do 1031.
Yeah, you have 1031. Yeah. Correct. There's no other option.
No. Or you just keep it.
You put the money in and you're basically saying, I'm keeping this property essentially
if you're
forever.
You're going to cash flow.
If you're making a lot of money in your personal job or whatever you're doing, you just buy one every year, never pay taxes, and you turn around, you have 10 of them, but it's all cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to sell them.
And it's all savings on today's dollars, not future dollars, which is very meaningful, especially as we go through an inflationary period.
So I'm sure you have clients that just buy these every year.
There's been several, yeah. And it's been a good boost for our business.
Are you running out of gas stations or car washes, I should say?
There's a lot of new ones being built.
Car washes.
Yeah. There's just been a lot of new players in the space, and we've helped finance a lot of their growth.
And car washes, I mean, what type of locations do you want those in? I mean, I see them all over the place, obviously.
Basically, every market needs one.
Yeah.
Right? You don't want them necessarily across the street from each other, but most markets could support at least one car wash.
And I'm sure you're starting to see these car washes. What about the ones that don't have employees? The ones that are like you drive in, you put like you scan something. I've seen those.
Yeah, it's just – and you could even, to your point earlier, I think you referenced like cost segregation studies. You could go get cost segregation studies on a lot of properties too if you're not looking for 100% bonus, and you could still expedite the scale and maybe get them down to 6, 7, 8 year schedule versus your typical.
Yeah.
So it's tremendous savings and ways to offset income.
So these car washes, these have corporate guarantees or these are franchise guarantees, and what kind of cap rates are they trading at?
Everything in between. I mean, we're working with operators with 2-3 locations, then we're working with some of the largest operators who are publicly traded in hundreds of locations around the U.S. So everything in between. The best in class car washes are probably in the low 6% range. And now you're seeing some of the smaller operators touching 7. So,
what's a big operator like Splash?
Like Mr. Car Wash and Take 5 are some of the big ones. Splash is a nice size operator.
From Connecticut, Splash is, that's pretty good.
They're financeable.
Yeah. There's definitely financing is more challenging today than it's been. And we're still navigating that space, but we're pounding the pavement and trying to find banks and lenders that will lend.
So car washes are expensive. There's not a lot to them. Like there's like that little space where you go in to like wash your car, get washed, but I guess all the equipment.
You'd be surprised. Yeah. The equipment's expensive. The build out's more expensive than you think.
The water bill.
The water bills, but that's that's secondary. It's just getting them opens some of the largest costs.
All right. When people are buying these, they're buying brand new ones or they're buying ones that are already existing? Does it matter?
It doesn't matter for bonus depreciation purposes, but they're buying both.
Cool.
So gas stations, 50% or more goes to fuel.
Yep.
Car washes. Then and you see like Pep Boys and stuff like that? Or no?
Those won't necessarily qualify, but some modular buildings too, if it's under, I think, 1,300 or 1,400 square feet, you'll get certain acceleration benefits as well.
All right. So that's interesting to anyone that makes money. A lot of money.
Definitely.
Yeah. More money, the better, obviously.
And it's an easy way to enter the net lease market and take some huge shelters.
Yeah. Okay.
That could be a real game changer.
Huge game changer.
For every year. All that income.
I mean, there's so many different vehicles, like literally vehicles, like big cars. There you can buy big cars.
Boats. Suburbans. Like, think about it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of this. Okay.
All right. So then, you know, I feel like this goes on more around the country than in New York, but it also goes on in New York. But there's people that go into the net lease space and they like know what a tenant's looking for. They buy the land or build a building or take over an existing store where there's not a good lease and reposition and put a much stronger lease in place. And then they can basically sell for a much higher value or refinance. So there's people that are making some serious, creating wealth in the net lease space.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's mainly developers, I believe, what you're talking about. And there's several developers who will either find good land and lock it up and then start approaching tenants, or maybe they have somebody in their back pocket, or those other developers that are out there searching for specific tenants.
And what about the guys like we were talking about before, like rewriting leases and renegotiating leases? The value is really outside the location. The piece of paper is huge.
There's tremendous value in the piece of paper, and there are opportunities where maybe you're willing to take the risk on a shorter term lease while somebody else might not want to take that risk. And maybe you get rewarded and you're able to get the tenant to extend for X, Y, and Z reason, or you find a higher and better use for the location. But not everybody wants to be a developer and take that risk.
Correct.
So that does create opportunities for people that are willing to take that risk.
But just it's interesting for us. I mean, a lot of our colleagues and friends, like we talk about triple net as just passive, and it's for someone that is, you know, a little older, that's looking to retire. But I do, like, especially after this conversation, like, there's definitely avenues to make those rips that you'd make in multifamily. Like, you just have to be a little.
There's definitely ways. I think the swings are probably a little bit less just because of the nature of the beast. But, there's definitely ways to make money.
I was thinking about this last night, I was brainstorming about this conversation. And the problem with multifamily redevelopment and where people make those big rips, it's so heavy to get from point A, from like A to Z. It's
like repositioning buildings.
Yeah, I mean, especially, I mean, here, but tenants. I imagine this is elsewhere too. You have to buy it. You have to get vacant units. You have to renovate and put in significant amount of capital to renovate. And then you obviously get the higher rents and you have a much higher income. And yeah, you go back to the bank or you go back to the market and you try to sell the same kind of cap rate that you went into it at. But you increase the rent roll so significantly that you created all this value, and then you can create wealth through, you know, multifamily redevelopment or even ground up development, however it may be. And net lease just seems so much simpler if you're smart about it. Yeah, well, it seems.
You can be, and you're also out of New York. I know New York's impossible to get anything done. There's certain markets that are much more business friendly.
You can make $1 million just picking up the phone.
Be like, Colorado, hey, sir. I think he found like a True Value hardware store. It was a hardware store.
Yeah, I see those.
I think there's like 2 years left on the lease, and he went in, he put it under contract, and he renegotiated with True Value, and I think put like a 20-year lease on it or something. And he bought it at like a 7 cap or an 8 cap because it was like short term left on the lease, and I think he thought he could resell it for a 5 or a 6. And I mean, I don't know if he executed on the deal or not, but I remember him telling me that he was going to make like, you know, over $1 million in profit just by rewriting the paper.
Let's just talk about the one that happened down the street here, right? So Crown, right? Mm-hmm. Huge, huge, huge retail office players
in Manhattan. Yep.
They bought something on Fulton Street, right? And they put a Chick-fil-A in.
They bought it for $25 million.
Which is a lot of money, but whatever. Yeah. It's $25 million. How much does it cost to build a Chick-fil-A with like a roof like they did over there?
I mean, in New York, you guys might know the metrics better than I. I'm sure it was costly, but regardless, they got a best-in-class tenant. And maybe they, I don't know, the whole chain of events of how maybe they had Chick-fil-A in their back pocket when they were buying this.
They
knew they had somebody, right? They saw an opportunity here where if we could re-tenant this and put somebody in here on a long-term lease, there's tremendous value in what they made.
Right, they put Chick-fil-A in.
So they paid $25 million for the real estate.
Yeah.
They built the building.
I'm sure they did, right? Is that how it works? You build
Yeah, you probably built it out for that tenant or for them significant TI and then free rent periods and everything
else. And then you
get
a long-term
lease. But it's not like high-end, right? Like it looked really nice. But
I'm sure it cost a fortune.
You're not putting like top-of-line like fixtures and stuff
that
you do.
That cost a fortune.
All right, so what, like $5 million bucks?
Well, interesting is they bought it for $25.
Okay.
Then a few years later, 3-4 years later, they refinanced for $29.
So that's – there you go. The 25 to the 29 is probably the build-out.
$4 million build-out.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. Yeah,
so they basically got all their cash out of the deal.
They put an elevator in that
piece. They own the building for free at that point.
Okay, fine.
Right?
We're making assumptions.
No, we are.
Yeah. Major assumptions, but usually a cash-out refi, you're taking out your purchase and the renovation cost.
What kind of financing they got when they purchased it. But say they bought it for 25 and they got a loan for like 20 and then they refinanced for 29. Right. So they got all their money back out of the deal, presumably.
Fine.
Then a few years later, I think a big institutional investor came along and bought it, guessing for like a 5 cap or something.
Probably
like
less, right?
Yeah, we probably less.
Back the numbers in, but yeah.
But they bought it for $38 million. So
But those guys were playing developer.
And yeah.
If they had the tenant at the time or not, that's a big check to write. There's not so many people could do that. And here we are in New York. We're talking on the most grandiose of scale in the U.S. But in smaller markets around the country, you're able to accomplish the same thing if you have the right real estate.
Yeah. A guy made a killing on the – like where I'm from in Connecticut, there was a Chipotle in Darien. I remember it went in. And I know that developer made a killing. Like he got Chipotle to be into that.
If you get the right tenant at the right location, people will pay big value for that.
Yeah, around the Post Road in Darien,
lot of these guys are building relationships with tenants, trying to figure out like what the tenants want, like where they want to be. Then they're like scouring the market to find the properties that they can essentially lock up and get the tenant to agree to use.
That's
and
what
then,
developers do.
And then they're making a spread on –
And there are, yes, there's a lot of money to be made. There's obviously risks too, where you're signing a lease today and it might not open for 2 years and a lot could change in the marketplace at any given point in time. I know today might be a decent point to enter the developer game, but think about a year or two ago where you were expecting your exit cap rate to maybe be 100 basis points less than reality is today.
For sure.
So
cap rates have moved a lot in New York. Yeah.
So a lot. If you're doing this to try to make money, you're a developer, you're someone that repositions triple nets, having a relationship with these tenants is absolutely massive, right? Like where you can actually call up like Wharton Properties. Like he's obviously retail royalty, but like everyone knows
he has his relationships
and like he was able to place tenants, right? And that's the value, right? It's a piece of paper.
That's it. You choose the right real estate with the right relationships and you get the right tenants in, there's tremendous value, but there's obvious risks. And the developers have had a really good run the last, call it almost 15 years. But now the market's more challenging. It's hard to predict what the world's going to look like in 2 years today, from 2 years from today than it was 4 or 5 years ago, when everything was trending in the right direction, the market felt healthy. Even like the pandemic changed the landscape a little bit, where pre-pandemic everybody had to be experiential real estate, and that was the buzzword, and everybody was trying to target that. And then the pandemic hit, and nobody was leaving their house, and you had to find properties with drive-throughs and properties that were less experiential that you could keep to yourself.
So. Do you see like any like cap rate compression too? Like let's say I buy like I don't know like a dollar store or some small time business for a 10 cap because whatever they're not the credit's not amazing, but then all of a sudden why I own it. A bigger corporation comes and gobbles up that company, and now all of a sudden the credit is much better.
I've seen a lot of people make a lot of money in that regard.
So that's more up my
I don't want to recommend buying smaller credits, but I've seen it several times over where these small guys will get gobbled up by larger, bigger credits, and it's a windfall for the landlord.
Like a Dollar Tree gets bought by Dollar General or something, right?
Like I sold a portfolio of gas stations several years back, and 7-Eleven ended up buying that company. So that was a huge credit enhancement for everybody that owned that real estate.
So that's like a full cap rate.
So what kind of cap rate was that at the beginning versus the end?
It was probably a 200 to 300 basis point swing in value. Wow.
That's insane.
Just on the credit changing.
Wow.
But how many times can you really do that?
That's just being lucky. Yeah. It's not – nobody knew that was going to happen or expected that to happen. It just – how it played out.
So I bet there's some like insider trading type of stuff that you could do in the space where like maybe you know the tenant, you can get them to overpay for the rent.
That's retail in a nutshell.
What's that, insider trading?
Being able to place tenants and getting to, hey, go here, don't go there. Like, I own this, like, but go here. Yeah, I mean, that's probably
really drive down.
That's frowned upon.
Yeah.
maximize rent, drive down the cap rate, make a spread.
So since we're obviously all in New York talking about this, and I know you were involved in some deals in good Brooklyn, like, can we touch on that Williamsburg deal you brought up a few years back?
Yeah.
I mean, how'd that work? That's prime real estate.
It is. It was on Wythe Avenue. It was really kind of a cool deal. And I love the seat we're in. I pride myself on trying to be creative, and I haven't even touched much on this yet, but I work on a team with 100 people, and everybody brings different tools to the table, and I love the atmosphere we're in. There's a lot of smart real estate people in the room, and we can bounce ideas off each other, and if somebody's doing something creative, we share it with the group. We have weekly meetings where we share ideas and problems, and we try to problem solve together, but I think just being around these people and hearing ideas and creating my own ideas. On that specific example, there was a nightclub there with a couple different leases, and it was a little bit of a funky structure day one. And I know that they had opinions of values from several of my competitors, and we came in with kind of a different strategy and a different way to position the asset. And we said, why don't we just ground lease this? We'll make it triple net. You guys put a ground lease on it. You control the real estate. And it really added a tremendous amount of value, making a triple net. There was an exchange buyer who bought it. They paid a premium for it. And
they bought the ground lease.
They bought the ground lease.
In a 1031.
Through a 1031 exchange.
Amazing.
And the ownership, I think, made an extra $1.5 million from this setup than they would have made on anybody else's proposal. So it was just coming
in. And you mentioned they still own the leasehold interest?
They still own the leasehold interest, and we locked it in at a fairly cheap rent, so they have flexibility to do some other things with the property over time.
And this is obviously prime real estate, A-plus real estate. So you're still able to do this.
Yeah.
So not only do they have the A-plus real estate, but they're also able to make money on doing some sort of triple net lease.
So they got a premium on selling the ground.
There's no risk there.
They're in the money already.
They sold the ground, but they're still renting out.
They still have rent obligations, but they have flexibility to change the use and do certain things there.
They have rent obligations on the ground lease. They can still make money on the business.
So there's a ton of opportunity just with landlords that own these warehouses in Prime Williamsburg and Greenpoint Queens, where they can put a tenant in and you come along with your team and you triple net lease it. And I mean, that's big.
It's adding value versus if you put multi-tenants in there and there's a lot of management, it's kind of just a different buyer bucket.
How do you do that?
Pay a premium.
If I had a warehouse in Prime Williamsburg, that's all I'm trying to do.
Just to take a step back. So the guys that sold the ground lease, they're still renting out the property and collecting rent from the tenants that are there. They just have to pay a rent on the ground lease.
Correct.
Is that right? Okay.
Correct. Yep.
So they're still making money on the property.
I think they've changed the uses a little bit. But yeah, I'm sure they're still making
money.
Is
the leasehold interest something that's sellable as well?
I mean, yes and no. Potentially, because it's in such prime real estate, and somebody might want just to have those rights, but it's definitely more challenging, harder to finance. I've done some leasehold transactions, and leaseholds will qualify for 1031 exchanges if there's over 30 years of term. Like, there's definitely some nuances and just to take note of there, but there's not a huge market for leasehold buyers.
Okay. What other kind of like funky deals or creative deals, like structures are going on out there?
I like being creative, but from my seat, I'm hitting a ton of singles and doubles. Like, it's a lot of what we do is a volume game.
Yeah.
It's a relationship game. It's just forming relationships with tenants and landlords and developers. And, you do right by these people over time, and they come back to you. Like, a big part of my business is referrals. That's how we stay in touch. Like,
for sure.
We've known you, I don't even know how long now, but we're constantly talking, and you guys have, hey, this person's looking to fulfill X, Y, and Z exchange. They want to learn more about net lease. Like, I'm not forcing this down anybody's throat, but it's an option, and I think a very viable one for people looking to kind of shelter some income and defer gains and take some different tax strategies.
Definitely is.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I mean, anything else you want to go over?
No, I mean, listen, I think we've heard a lot of podcasts and discussions about triple net. And it's always so entry level, like Sally Joe sold this building in Brooklyn and bought a CVS. And it's nice to hear from you guys. Obviously, I think you're probably the most active group in Triple Net in the country. Or if you're not number one, you're definitely close, but you're probably number one.
I think we are.
Okay, you're number one.
Not to float our own boat, but yeah,
you're number one. Yeah. It's good to get into like the meat and potatoes. Like, how do people make money? Where's the opportunity? Like, what's good? What's not? Yeah. And there's definitely a real aspect to Triple Net to make money, and it's cool, an avenue.
It's still not such a household name as much as you guys hear it and know it, just being in the commercial real estate space. I'll go to a party and tell people I'm in real estate and be like, oh, could you sell my house? Like, it's still, I say net lease and people look at the blank stare.
My father-in-law is a good example here. I mean, he owns commercial properties for his business in Connecticut, and he just did a nice 1031. He did not do triple net, but I brought this up to him, and I think it was definitely new to him. And we still have calls all the time with people that own multifamily that do not know. What do you say? Google NNN. You know, just Google it.
And big owners, too.
Google 1031.
Yeah, Google NNN.
People with $50, $100 million portfolios that just didn't even know this was an option or never considered it. And now maybe they, at a different point in time, they're willing to look at it. And it makes a lot of sense.
It makes sense. I mean, this was a good conversation. And the tax benefit, that's huge, too. I mean, I've heard this a lot, obviously, with the car wash. I mean, if you're making a big income, I mean, it's like a no-brainer. Any kind of income. I shouldn't say big, but if you're making... I mean, a lot of our clients and friends are just in huge tax brackets, and it eliminates that. I mean, I know people that build buildings just so they don't pay taxes.
Do you have to be a real estate professional to get those benefits?
Yes and no. I mean, talk to your advisors. There's different ways to bucket it versus passive and active losses. But yeah, I've seen it structured several different ways.
Mm-hmm. All right,
cool. Anything else you'd like to go over?
No, I mean, it's going to be an interesting year, I'd say. I think we'll see what it holds. And as much as I'd love to tell you I know, but I've been wrong several times over. And anybody tells you they know, they don't.
So. Are people being forced to sell net lease properties? Like here in New York, we're seeing a lot of loans coming due. And the values are down with cap rates being higher or just with higher interest rates. The owner can't refinance. It's a cash in refi. So a lot of people's feet are kind of being held to the fire at this point. And are you seeing the same thing on the net lease side?
Not a ton. Definitely a little bit. And I'm having more discussions today where people had loans and they're coming due.
That's good.
And I'm sure you're seeing in New York, these banks don't want the properties back.
No, but they also want their money back,
too. Banks want their money back.
Their money back, but a lot of times they're extending. As much as they're saying they don't want to, they're working with
it. They have been. A lot of people think that's about to stop.
We'll see. Obviously, rates are higher today, and it's unfortunate. And part of our job's having the tough discussions, right? And that it's not all rainbows and unicorns. And I have to, like, talk to some of these clients, say, hey, you had a 70% loan on this property. The rate was 5%. Now the rate's 7%. And with the debt service coverage ratio, you might have to come out of pocket a couple hundred grand to make this work. And it's a difficult discussion, but you have to be real with people. You have to give them the right advice. And I think that's why people like us and work with us, because that's what we do.
Quick question, though. Well, on a typical 1031, like what kind of LTV do people usually do? Are they putting down like 25%, or is it more like conservative 50% down?
You usually need at least 35% down. Some of the banks have upped that to like 40% recently.
Even when rates we're talking about a few years back.
A few years ago, I'd say 35 was kind of the comfortable metric. Now it might be 40, 45.
That's conservative. I mean,
as long as it covers.
We saw a ton of 25% down deals.
There wasn't a lot of that getting done in that lease. And
it shouldn't. Good.
Yeah. I can't tell you how many times other brokers around the country would say, hey, I got this buyer 20% down.
20%.
I think about zero of those transactions worked out. So
maybe that's why maybe that's why you're getting less calls about people having issues with banks.
Yeah. And we try to educate people properly, show them the risk, show them the rewards. And we're here as an advisor. And just because it's somebody bought a property for me 10 years ago, they still call me all the time. We're friends. We talk. And that's one of the aspects I love to this business. There's so many cool people in the industry that you get to meet and interact with and learn about their lifestyle and their family and just learn from their life lessons.
Yeah. I have a lot of clients that still love you for obvious reasons.
Definitely.
Yeah. So it's good. It's good to hear. It's good to see. And we appreciate it.
No,
for sure.
Thanks for having me, guys.
100%. All right. So Russ Walkler, NNN Pro. Thanks so much.
All right.
All right.
All right. Thanks, guys.